This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Dug Too Deep, the officially unofficial podcast for The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. On Amazon Prime, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're back with another episode for episode 3, titled Adar. This is a feedback episode. Aaron, I hear tell of a large book full of feedback.
Yeah, there's a tome, the Red Book of Feed March, and it's written in Harfoot hand.
Oh, okay. I was going to see if it was marked with the symbol of Sauron or...
Well, but only heat can reveal it. You have to throw it in a fire and then it's paper. So it doesn't have the same kind of like, you know, it just burns.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get to read the words as each page is burnt from in front of you and then it's done. So
perfect.
We're going to read that and not throw it in a fire. Dug2deep at baldmove.com is how you send us. So you're like, how do I get these takes on the air? Well, you can run the gauntlet at dug2deep at baldmove.com. Did you have any other thoughts on the... The Lorehounds lore podcast came out just this morning while I was compiling feedback, and I didn't have a chance to listen to it yet. That was one of my regrets. I've had a busy weekend.
No, I had roughly the same problems that I had on first watch. On second watch, I didn't feel like it was any better or worse.
I felt like we're in pretty good company, as we'll see in the feedback. Finally, Dug Too Deep at baldmove.com. Let's move on to Lena, who says, "Hey, boys." Hey, Lena. Quick note, the Bronwyn tells Arondir in episode 2, the town they are going to investigate is where she's from. So turns out he didn't bounce her on his knee as a babe. As a baby, might bounce around his knee as a babe. I don't know.
So he was watching over a different city?
That was my question. This Os Tirith, is it just for the one settlement? I would have thought that the whole idea of Arondir and his buddy going around from town to town was like he was on some kind of migratory cycle. Like every few weeks he would stop by and be like, all right, are you guys evil again? Mm-hmm. I don't know what kind of watch this is. Like, are you evil? Have you felt any evil stirrings?
You know, a tinge. Yeah, the other day.
Has any cows gone around giving blood milk? Have you seen any black rot amongst your corn? No.
Suspicious
okay.
Tunnels.
I'll be back in 2 weeks to see if you guys have gone evil again.
You're probably right. You can't really install a tower for every town. I just don't.
I mean, you could.
You could. Why?
How paranoid are these elves, you know?
Yeah.
Probably pretty paranoid. They thought their joys would be unending, and now they're like the boomers, you know? No one told them that there might be bad things. No, that's not true. Anyway, yeah, I don't know. I guess it just depends. We've got a lot of email on this. The idea about the elves and their viewing of age gaps and humans in general that we'll get to later on. Layla says a lot of lay and Layla and Lena is up front. Slight throwback to the first episode. Do you think that Finrod or Lindor, as Aaron prefers, I'm going to hear about that a lot. I can tell.
Yeah.
Do you think that Finrod's words of wisdom to Galadriel were a callback or, I guess, call forward to Frodo and Sam going through the dead marshes? They had to keep looking forward and to keep their hopes alive, like the boat that Finrod mentioned. If Frodo and Sam looked down into the faces of the dead and despaired, they would fall into the marshes, sink like a stone, and be lost forever. To me, this makes Finrod's last line to his sister even more interesting because it basically seems to say that sometimes the only way to tell the difference between good and evil is to touch the darkness. Seems risky. What do you guys think?
It's interesting. I know there are a lot of repeating themes in Tolkien's work, and I could certainly see this being one. Maybe it's not like, you know, consciously or directly related, but certainly thematically, yeah, it could be.
Yeah, I think it is an interesting point that it's all well and good to, like, you know, keep looking up, keep being positive. But that sometimes that advice only will take you so far. If you're in the middle of like an existential war, or if you're in the middle of, you know, maybe there's groups of people that you think are lying to you that you care about, and people that think that are, you know, looking after your best interests. What's the best path for you to follow when there doesn't seem like there's any path clearly defined ahead? I guess, like, if you are a person of pretty strong moral convictions and fortitude, what fear would you have to, like, just randomly pick a path, you know, and like, I'm going to use my gut and my intuition? Because otherwise it seems like you would say, well, you just never get off the boat. Like, you know, that's not going to be the wise course of action if your boat gets hit by an iceberg, you know, like, well, I'm just going to stay on this boat because I don't know. You know, you got the light above and the light below. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah, I feel you. It's like if someone got cancer and the diagnosis was bad and they were like, I don't know, it'll be fine. It'll work itself out, right?
Right.
And so they just didn't go seek treatment for it because they were always looking up. I don't know. Yeah, that probably wouldn't work out very well for them. Need a touch to touch the darkness to get treatment for that.
Yeah, like in general, and good to live well, you don't want to drink poison. You want to stay away from radioactive stuff, and you certainly don't want steel carving your flesh.
Right.
But to survive cancer, you're going to have to probably do all three of those things under the care of a physician and all that kind of stuff. So, like, I think there's a little of that, you know, that, like, if you want to be a person of action, and you're at a branch in life where it's uncertain which is the ethical and moral way to go forward, like, it's not like saying swim in the darkness. It's more of like, don't be so afraid of swimming in the darkness that you just stay paralyzed on shore.
Yeah.
Because that can lead to a lot of great evil too. If the people that are just like, you know, I don't know, I'll just sit on the side and let's see what happens with the good and evil situation here. Totally. That's how I looked at it anyway. Ruby says, I listened to your feedback show where you're talking about the viewing numbers, and you're right to distress any corporate numbers provided by Amazon. I knew it. I fucking knew that Bezos was up to no good. Samba TV does a breakdown by smart TV devices that looks at household. Now, there is an article from Media Play News that I'm going to be quoting from here. Ruby says, the Rings of Power had decent numbers, but it's not beating House of Dragon or even Stranger Things 4 yet. I think Rings of Power is a decent show, way better than Wheel of Time, and visually amazing, but the writing, storytelling, and acting nowhere near close to the House of the Dragon or Stranger Things. So from this article, it says, Prime Video announced the premiere of its highly touted and expensive prequel series, The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, was viewed by 25 million people, the most of any Amazon original content. We reported that last week. We're like, wow, that's a fucking a lot of people, but that's a lot of people. New data from the Samba TV suggests the Rings bow, while good, was not as spectacular as hyped. Now, you might ask, what is this Samba stuff? Samba gathers viewership data via proprietary technology on opted-in smart TVs across 24 of the top smart TVs globally purchased, and captured content that crosses the TV screen regardless of source. That means it's not looking at, it's actually looking at the pixels being displayed at the screen to report this information.
This now, is why I have never hooked my smart television up to the internet, because fuck that.
You still want anybody knowing what you're watching, huh?
Absolutely not. Are you kidding?
So now keep in mind, we are trusting one opaque corporation over another opaque corporation. When we talk about this proprietary technology, but again, as I said, new data suggests that the Rings, while good, might not be as spectacular as hyped. Indeed, 1.8 million U.S. households watched The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, episode one on Prime Video during the L+3 day. This is the release plus 3 day. It's often used in streaming media. According to Samba TV, another 1.3 million U.S. households watched episode two during the L+3 day window. The series debut marked Prime Video's highest three-day viewership of any 22 premiere on the platform. Yet, the debut of the first episode of Season 4 of Stranger Things generated 2.9 million U.S. household watches. The debut of Obi-Wan Kenobi on Disney Plus generated 2.1 million households tuning in. They also had some other demographics information, such as HBO's House of Dragon premiere over-indexed by 3% among Gen Z, while Prime's Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, under-indexed by 4% amongst the same audience, indicating House of Dragon might be doing a better job attracting younger viewers. Again, that's a 7-point swing. That's significant, but I don't know if it's earth-shattering. Samba found there was also a viewership drop-off between episodes 1 and 2 of The Rings of Power, indicating that about 1 in 4 households that watched episode 1 were not interested in continuing to watch the next episode within that initial L+3 window. You'll recall that House of Dragon gained, I think, 3 or 4% season episode 1, episode 2. So
yeah, I think there's a difference when you release them at the same time, though. People, you know, might not have time for 2 full hours of television, whereas they do for one.
In 4 days? I do think that if that...
It's the weekend. I don't know.
And it's Labor Day weekend, right?
Yes. I can't remember, but...
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Could be that, you know, people were just out doing other things. Didn't have time for your second episode.
The other wrinkle is that Samba does not include viewership on non-TV devices such as mobile phones. However, if you were to Chromecast or otherwise Apple TV watch across your TV, it would still get that because, again, it's doing pixel comparison. I don't know. I hear tell a lot of young kids, a lot of young folk, you know, 30 and younger, watch a lot of shit on phones, which blows my mind. But
it blows my mind, too, but not for the same reason, I'm sure. It blows my mind because that entirely occupies your phone. And that is not what I think a young person wants to do. I would think they would want to background watch while using the phone for some other purpose.
Yeah. What are you doing? Just like you're just ignoring all the text bubbles, or are you like super distracted where it's like every 30 seconds something comes and you pause and you respond to them and you get back and
I don't know.
I think that it wouldn't surprise it. So I find it hard to believe that Amazon would just lie. But I bet that there's a way that they can look at the numbers. For example, podcasts 5 years ago used to go by raw download metrics, like how many bits were transferred versus how many bits total, divide that, and that's a fucking full listen. However, the way streaming stuff works, it turns out, like, you know, as people more and more stop downloading entire episodes and just stream them, there's a lot of those bits that are being overcounted. So in the last 5 years or so, they've gone to unique listeners. And in our case, that's cut our perceived traffic in probably, by an order of magnitude? So, like, I'm wondering if Amazon is using some kind of, like, well, find how many total bits we transferred, divide that by how many bits the average episode is, maybe divide it by the average bits of a 720p, because how many people got 4K televisions, and boom, you got 24 million people watching. Because I do not believe, based on everything I've seen, based on feedback, based on podcast traffic, based on subreddit post engagement on our Discords, it just doesn't seem like Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power is as big as House of the Dragon.
Let alone like 2.5 times.
Yeah. Unless the other thing is, unless there's just a lot of family and older audiences watching Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, that are not watching House of the Dragon, and those people just don't, you know, like if my dad's watching Rings of Power because he really enjoyed, you know, in his 50s watching the shows come out, like it, yeah, maybe, and they're just not on podcasts.
He's watching it while he's scrolling TikTok on his phone. So.
My dad's such a notorious TikToker.
Yeah. We got a lot of Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be right back after this short break.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And now, let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep.
Anyway, thanks for that other perspective, Ruby. Let's move on to Raphael. Says, big time fan, been with you on this journey for more shows than I can remember. Well, thank you very much. Just watched the third episode and the cinematography continues to be stunning. In your take at the first two episodes, you mentioned if after some time we could get tired of this, and I think not. Numenor is just beyond amazing. When I watched the original Lord of the Rings trilogy, it always seemed like it was a world past its prime. The elves are leaving, dwarves are nowhere to be found, and men seem like they'd seen better times. I got two questions for you guys. Am I correct to assume that this era is the peak of all three civilizations? All three races seem to be having a zenith based on their cities and culture.
I would guess the elves wouldn't see it that way. Their height was probably when they all lived in Valinor, but
so, like, one of the things that I've appreciated from the Lorehounds coverage and stirring of high school memories reading this stuff is that one of the things that the elves has got is that they, you know, you've got a big fish in small pond and small fish in big pond kind of thing. And a lot of powerful elves in the land of Valinor are those big fish in a very big pond. You know, there's like high elf lords mm-hmm. and literal demigods walking that continent. So if you think like, hey, you know what? I bet I could build a bang ass civilization. I could be a nice head of state. You got nowhere to be. In Middle Earth, you know, there's a land rush going on. There's elves forging these kingdoms and whatnot. And now that men are coming on strong and forming their own civilizations, and dwarves are now like elves want to carve out their own place and hold on to what they got. So I don't think it's their peak, but it's not far off, and they're trying to find ways to keep that peak going through their decline. Because as the Lorehounds mentioned, that like elves have a finite percentage of elf juice. Let's call it elf juice that okay, that they're born with, and as they create, whether that's children or powerful artifacts or great civilizations, they invest some of that elf juice into those things, and they can't get it back. Once all that elf juice is gone, they literally fade away into a spirit and they can no longer interact with Middle Earth. Their only thing to do there is to go to the halls of Mandos, where they can hang out with the other faded elves and wait for the end of everything on Earth to transpire. So elves doing all these mighty works now, like they're probably starting to feel pretty dry and desiccated from an elf juice perspective. What do you do? What do you do to hold on to that? What temptations might you give into if you were granted another couple thousand years of keeping this good thing going? Then on the men, it's the opposite. It's just like you see all these elves, you know, you're born and you know this elf guy, and maybe you live a couple hundred years because you're one of the mighty men, but that dude hasn't aged a day and you're about to die. What the fuck? I want some of that elf juice, you know. Some things are going to be driving to conflict. But yeah, I think you're right that this is probably the mightiest of all of the, you know, physical creation at this time. Let's say second, is Amazon Bezos exploring a new genre where they blend storytelling and going for broke tight cinematography? I say this because I've only seen this kind of cinematography in nature shows, such as Planet Earth, etc. I've never seen a TV show that really takes advantage of our new 8K, 4K technological world. Frankly, I think it's overdue. For some time, I felt that most of the content out there doesn't take full advantage of what modern TVs can do. What do you think of that?
I think that's fairly true. Look at the budget it took to get it done. I don't think there are a lot of companies that even could, let alone would, spring for this kind of show. Because you got to have a certain amount of reach and like guaranteed reach to make this worthwhile. So yeah, I think like this show does look better than basically anything that I've ever seen on television. And I think you'll probably get more of this as, you know, the tech gets cheaper, all these effects get easier, because it's going to continue to happen. But I don't know. It's a very good looking show, yes. And I appreciate like having it in HDR, full 4K, super high streaming bitrate. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
I think it's telling that when you go into a TV store or whatever, a Costco or a Sam's Club, that like all the TVs are displaying these nature images like waterfalls mm-hmm. and the Serengeti and the fucking Amazon tree frog on a waxy green branch, because it's incredibly expensive. I mean, as we're seeing with Amazon's Lord of the Rings, it's incredibly expensive to stuff every inch of a 60-inch TV at 8K with like kind of detail that's like worth doing. Like when you look at cinematic mode, a lot of TVs, what do? They up the yellow, they turn down the contrast, they make the picture softer, they turn on motion blurring, because cinema is just not that precise. You always need that kind of like, you know, Vaseline coat on the surface of the camera glass so that you can see the fact that this shit is fake as fuck. You know, you don't want to see that. You want to get mm-hmm. that preserve, like, oh yeah, if I squint, this seems real. So I think that's, yeah, like it's just expensive to do that kind of world building where
you
like
get all
everything
that stuff for free in, because you remember when it was football games, right? They used to have football games running when 1080p was the thing, because
yeah,
they were all being recorded in 1080p. It's real world scenarios. So all you got to do is point the camera at it, and it
you
looks.
You can
great.
See every blade. Yeah, how many times you can see every blade of grass on the field? What? Yeah, because it's not fake.
And the same is true of nature documentaries. They're just pointing a camera at something. It's an amazing high resolution, amazing lens camera, but they're just pointing it.
Yeah. Coral reef is as amazing as Numenor, but no one had to go and fucking set direct it, you know, and set dress it rather. Yeah, because like I said, it is expensive. I think as digital technology gets better and better, and crucially because like, you know, think about how much time it takes to render like a beautiful 1080p scene. Now quadruple the pixels for a 4K, quadruple mm-hmm. the pixels again for an 8K. Think of the bandwidth. Think of the computer processing time. It's expensive. So, mm-hmm. Andrea says, it broke my heart when Sadok read out all those proud fellows who died in a landslide. I had to look it up to be sure, but turns out Poppy is a proud fellow. It puts her concern for Nori and the events with Meteor Man in a different, extremely endearing light. Yeah, thanks for doing that, because I was definitely moved, because I'm a big Poppy fan, and seeing her bawling her eyes out at the list of people left behind was definitely moving, and it makes sense that she broke on those, because yeah, it's her family, and her being worried about Nori's family going through this, her best friend's family going through perhaps the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mike says, hey guys, just listened to the recap podcast and was falling off my horse laughing about your discussion of the horse cheesing scene. My second watch, I couldn't help but put Eddie Murphy's voice in the horse's head when he smiles at the camera. This is the Shrek quote. Reminds me of when Donkey is turned into a white bronco and he's prancing around saying, you hear what she said? I'm a trusty steed. Yeah, that white horse was giving a lot of trusty steed performance.
Mm-hmm.
And deserves an Emmy to be best supporting horse. If anyone else gets it, like, we should riot, right?
Yeah.
Billy says, I think this is the first time I've substantially disagreed with the bald move take on something. Are you strapped in, Jim? Are you in a place where you can receive criticism?
Sure.
All right. I thought that the first T-Rop episode was stronger than the first two and got me really excited for the rest of the season. First off, I am a Tolkien fan, and I know these characters and locations pretty well, and I love how deep they're continuing to get with the lore. This is something I predicted. You remember I said in the very beginning of... Yeah, it's like, I get excited when I hear the name Elendil and Isildur and Numenor and Al-Pharazôn and stuff like that, because I'm like, oh, fuck yeah, the story's about to get good.
I get squinty-eyed.
Yeah, if you've never read the appendixes or the Silmarillion or the Unfinished Tales, you're like, these are just more crazy ass names mm-hmm. that I'm going to have to learn and make associations with. And it feels like being given out homework rather than a dream you've had since high school, you know?
Well, you got to make these people, you got to make these names into people, into characters that I care about.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the most important thing.
And also, these shows aren't meant to be diagnosed at a minutia, episode by episode, minute by minute. You're supposed to watch a whole season and be like, hey, I wonder what I thought of that. So, like, we had two amazing episodes. One episode where it's like, I'm not going to say it's not, it's a bad episode. It's just we really shifted into the deep part of the lore and a lot of names and a lot of things coming forward, not a new locations. And, you know, you're not getting the benefit of essentially just leaning on Galadriel and Elrond and our leftover, you know, enthusiasm for hobbits slash Harfoot. You know, some of this stuff starts to have to stand on its own. Like, there's long stretches where just Arendil and Elbrand, what's his name? Hellbrand. Yeah. Having to carry the action. And we got some other feedback where it's like, well, yeah, anytime you meet new characters, there's no reason to care about them. When you start a new movie and some dude jumps on the screen for 30 seconds, you're like, who is this fucker? Why should I care about them? Mm-hmm. But you kind of are. Like, if you're three out,
a character introduction is supposed to be something that connects you with the character.
Yeah.
And if a lot of them do that, it's a bad one. But
and a lot of the non-main character introductions we've had so far have been almost a mystery, because like he's not Halbrand, the guy who's immediately recognizable. You know what he's all about when he stops on the screen. It's Halbrand, the mysterious stranger who's probably got a lot more going on to them. You mm-hmm. know, it's
and
a meteor
fine,
man.
Too.
It's fine.
I'm not opposed
but...
to a mysterious person as kind of the hook. I just didn't feel like there was enough mystery to Elendil for me to actually like grab onto that and say, okay, his thing is he's a mystery. They like halfway rode that between like, oh, he's a good guy who's going to help Galadriel, and he's a mystery where there's more to uncover. And I wasn't feeling either side of that, especially.
Yeah.
Much.
Yeah. And there's also a lot of this Numenorean. It's like they're having a smug off, you know, like we are the superior men of Middle Earth, sure. But I'm the more superior one because I'm keeping the ways pure and I still love the elves. Well, you're an elf. You know, it's like it's a lot of like it's politics, man. Mm-hmm. I thought the orc prison camp scenes were outstanding and did a great job establishing the stakes of this looming content. Billy continues conflict, rather. Mm-hmm. All the looming content in the last few weeks. Uh-huh. These orcs to me felt a lot more evil and intelligent than those in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. They felt a lot more realistic and menacing, both in the design and action. These guys are terrifyingly human-like and malicious in a way that goes beyond the cartoonishness I sometimes felt from the orcs in Lord of the Rings. The elf's executions and the warg attacks seem much more significant, emotional, and scary than similar scenes in a trilogy. Have we ever seen humans or elves enslaved by orcs before and them interacting in this way, other than, of course, Merry and Pippin being used as luggage? I thought that shit was great. Regarding the lack of communication between elves and how they all end up in the camp, I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that these orcs either did some blitzkrieg attack or just watching the perimeters of the Southlands in force, and the elves are either just understanding this after winding up in the camp or aren't able to communicate it in detail. In Numenor, I thought the introduction of Isildur and the cadets learning to sail did a lot to establish the society of the Numenoreans and their technology and the seafaring capabilities, though I have no insight into rope pulling. Okay. I thought the introduction to the family is quite reasonable. Overall, I love the feel of Numenor and how the city really felt like a lived-in place. We've never seen a city like this in Lord of the Rings. There's no commoner, normal life stuff in Gondor in the movies or even the books, really. They're doing an excellent job creating these scenes and vibes with only the most high-level details to go off of. I mean, yeah, I don't think any of this is not true, but I also think from people that are not as steeped in the lore, it is all this stuff is, while great, could also be intimidating and impenetrable, you know?
Sure, no, but I agree with, like, the orc stuff. I thought those scenes were great. I thought, yeah, the city of Numenor itself, or it's not a city, right? It's a land. What?
It's an island.
It's an island, but they go to
different
parts of it.
It's called Numenor. Yeah, there's different parts and cities and whatnot. Yeah.
So what do I call the city that they were in?
Numenor Prime. That'd be a great question for John and David, because I honestly don't know the different parts of Numenor that well. I saw a map of it, and it looked like there's different cities and whatnot.
Yeah. That city felt real, felt lived in. I agree with that. I liked all that stuff. It was just really the storytelling that I had the problem with in that particular section of the show.
Apparently, the city we were in is Arminelos.
Arminelos.
The capital city of Numenos. I might be butchering it. Arminelos. But yeah, that's the city of kings there on Numenor.
Okay.
And I, like I said, you're right. They did, like, if nothing else, you understand the Numenor is a seafaring people. Mm-hmm. They're of the sea. That's where they're most comfortable. They trust in the sea. That's like they have a spiritual connection to it. And also, if you compare, like you mentioned, like commoners, we saw the Southlanders are living. They're like in that burlap and, you know, sackcloth culture where everything's just kind of rough hewn and they're farming mud. And
I mean, their community leader also works as an innkeeper. So,
right. And a butcher.
They don't
and
exactly
baker.
Have a queen. Yeah.
He might make candlesticks on the side. You compare that to Numenor, like even the blue collar people are wearing gold and fine silver and they're closer to elves. Like, you know, I always thought it's hilarious in The Lord of the Rings. I think it's the Return of the King where they're reforging Aragorn's sword and they show elven smiths and they're all wearing their green jumpsuits and their hair is done perfect and their makeup's done perfect. And just they've got these like just gracile hammers. Ting! Ting! Like, if you've ever seen a blacksmith shop, it's a fucking OSHA violation in just brought to earth. And the elves still have everything. Like, Numenor is closer to that, where even the people that work hard or tradespeople still are fine and manifestly educated and literate and not so far off of the people, you know, that are leading them.
They're living well.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, they got a lot what the seems like people like the those Southlands would want for themselves, too. Let's move on to Justin. Says, one thing that took me out was all the orc canopies over the tunnel. There's this huge river of canopies growing over the land. How can they have not have noticed it? Speaking of the elves, there haven't been elves watching over the Southlands for a century. Maybe I missed something, but it seems like these canopies are a dead giveaway.
Maybe. Probably.
It's possible that these these things are effective camouflage, you know, seen from the air. It's also like I thought they were also telling a story of maybe the orcs were spreading a little more slowly deeper underground because they're under houses and whatnot. They're spreading under entire human settlements and people think it's like rats under there. I wonder if they're at close to the surface now because they know that the elves have abandoned their quest. They've taken most of those wardens hostage, and now they're like, we're so close to the goal of finding, I think, the rusty sword is what they're looking for, that they're now acting pretty much in open, just bothering to cover themselves from the sun, and that's it.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise, yeah, these elves are, boy, they're not as sharp-eyed as we've been led to believe. Irish Monk says, I love your show in the pod. This is the first episode where I got worried about the pacing. Consider this as a thought experiment. At the end of the previous episode, we saw Iron Deer abducted only to wake in a haze in the orc camp. And this, at the end of this episode, we see him awaken in a haze at the chance of Adar. What if instead of the failed escape scenes we had in this episode, we just had him waken to the haze of the chance of Adar? What would we have missed? His two pals, the warg, the orcs that hate light, action scenes. To be honest, I was not wondering about the fate of his pals. We could have shown the warg, the orcs that hate light, and had action scenes in ways that move the characters and plot along. My point is, if you can remove an entire episode's worth of scenes and not lose anything about the character and plot arc, should they be included at all?
That's a very good question. I certainly enjoyed those scenes, but yeah, you're right. They're not essential. I mean, what's the difference here between the elves being captured and killed versus the elves just going home? I guess there's still some of them are still there to be led by Arendir if he so chooses, but like and he saw something up on this ridge. I'm trying to remember when he gets over the ridge what he sees. It just looks like more woods to me.
He saw his friend getting slaughtered, and like in the far off distance there were just rings of orcs, you know, or maybe men. Because those orcs are out in the sun. Maybe these are Southrons that are going along with the regime.
Yeah. So, I mean, if they use that information, then I guess it was somewhat important. Although, you know, there are a million ways to get that information to Arendir, right?
Well, and also it's like it's a pretty hack cliche to have a leader like, you know, take us to your leader and they just bring you. They bring some dude. Because Arendir is just some dude. He's a low-ranking warden and a whole hierarchy of, and this is itself an outpost of a much larger, more powerful elf civilization, right? Why the fuck would Adar go meet this guy? Like, he's not the first elf they capture, won't be the last. He just makes a habit of, like, intimidating personally every prisoner. So you kind of got to set him up as being a thorn in the enemy's side.
Yeah, good point.
So he gets personal attention from Big Papa here. Do you need 15 minutes out of an hour episode to do that? I don't know. But
when it's as well done as this, I certainly don't mind.
Because I think there'd be a lot of people saying, oh, my God, this guy just shows up and he just immediately introduced to the second ranking evil person in the whole continent. Like, oh, this is jetpacking. This is not paying it. You know, like you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. And again, just three episodes in, we got five more. A lot can change here. Steven says in Dug Too Deep episode 3, Jim mentioned it took him 2.5 hours to get through the episode due in part because the avalanche of names we were subjected to. My ears picked up and I smiled as I thought, I know exactly how I can help Jim. It's called the audio description feature. It's a necessary feature on more and more media for the blind and visually impaired individuals like myself, so we can have a viewing experience and parity with sighted audiences.
I did this with the movie Palm Springs, which was a very strange experience.
That was like the kind of dark Groundhog Day.
Andy Samberg and yeah, it was an interesting experience.
He says, I like to use this. I don't always use it and sometimes it's not available, but sometimes on shows like The Rings of Power and Hot D, I turn it on because the narrator usually repeats names and identifies important set pieces or MacGuffins that I might otherwise miss or forget after the scene ends. Like your podcasts often depend on AD to fully appreciate shows and movies. He says he's a composer and who's partially sighted. One of his side jobs is working with studios in Hollywood to add AD to more shows and movies. Although Amazon is one of the worst offenders when it comes to dependable quality AD. T-Rop, for example, has rather Spartan AD, where their shows like HBO on Hot D have amazing AD and also happen to be narrated by a fellow AD advocate Roy Samuelson. So he's like, when in doubt, use one of your bonus viewings to turn on AD and see if it doesn't illuminate some of these names and locations better.
I think like I try and watch with subtitles on that watch because I'm extremely strapped for time is what it is in that first viewing, because I need to be certain that I will have an outline for the following morning when we record the podcast. So my first watch, that's the thing with this. I try and get as close to the experience of the general viewer, right? Mm-hmm. As I can on my first watch. There's an exception here because I may or may not have time to get through a watch and then a rewatch with an outline. So I have to make sure that I get that outline. And that's why I watch it the first time and pause and rewind and do all these things, which a general viewer is not going to do.
Yeah.
So I don't know. The AD stuff I'm certain it would help in that regard, but it's going to take me probably even farther from the general experience of a viewer. So I don't know. Stuff.
Yeah, because like it's like he's trying to strike the balance of like what, because most people, the vast majority of the people watch the stuff once. And then you start listening to podcasts and stuff. So, like, you want to respect that. But on the other hand, like, you also try to get, you know, you try to help the people that have seen it only once appreciate the deeper complexities. Maybe their kid was screaming in the background for a scene. So, like, yeah, those kind of tools are pretty, pretty valuable.
And it's just and this podcast is a weird thing because we're recording the podcast the very next day, early on in the very next day. And I don't have time necessarily to do all the stuff that I would do on a regular podcast, which we have 2 days to prep and cover,
especially since we're really talking, when you're saying one day, you're talking 12 hours
during eight of which I should be ideally sleeping.
Yeah. Like they are really kind of screwing us with the midnight releases of the Rings of Power. So, but we're doing the best we can. Thanks for the email. Moving on to J Cube says, I may be carrying 40 years worth of baggage and admittedly don't care that much for jazz in general, but I'm not loving the story direction in these three episodes. Beautiful show, unquestionably, but story and writing don't rise up to the visuals. It's funny how people rag on the Hobbit movies, which I don't entirely hate. Whoa. Interesting opinion detected. But to me, the show has big Hobbit energy, way more than the Lord of the Rings, at least. I have big problems with Galadriel's characterization. She's on this blind vengeance quest, which seems wildly out of character after we can assume she has witnessed what she has witnessed from Feanor and his son's similar obsession with Morton.
Say what?
Morgoth, I'm guessing, is what they're saying here. And the Cimmerils. Aeron talked about how she was younger and impetuous, but she's literally 5,000 years old at this point. Okay. She's 5,000 years, but these are elf years, man, which I think the Lorehound said are like 144 human years.
Okay.
So like what's 5,000 divided by 144? That is 34 years old. She's a spry 34 year old.
All right.
Which is but a child as elves account it. You just got to look, let's see. You got so this reminds me a lot of like I always thought it was dumb in Lord of the Rings where Legolas was literally like dumbstruck at the idea of someone dies and like processing grief because Legolas is 3,000 years old. But if you do that math, he's barely 18. And maybe in his life during the mostly peaceful Third Age, he's never seen anyone die. So like you kind of like you either get the fact that these are truly immortal beings that see time differently. And they said that in the first episode with Elrond. Like, I think it wasn't like he just doesn't care about Durin. It's that he literally we lost touch for 20 years. That's like me not texting my friend for a week. We'll be fine when, you know, we get back. And to see the mortal elf like really hurt and offended by that. I think you just have to either have to grant that to the elves or you're going to have problems with it because like a lot of what they do is aloof and unseemly unless you really understand that concept. J-Cube says, I think the creators are trying to have their cake and eat it too. They've taken out nearly 2,000 years of lore from the show and condensed it, but then use up half of their runtime with completely new content they've made up. That new content might be better than the part that they're actually adapting. But they also drop deep lore bombs nearly out of nowhere with very little context for casual watchers. I think this is a symptom of the fact that they really only have the Lord of the Rings and the appendixes in those books. And all this stuff, like, you know, the Lorehounds helped me appreciate the fact that a lot of the stuff in the Silmarillion, they just can't use. They might be able to reference it if it was name checked in like a song or something. That's another thing that a lot of songs name check these old myths and legends like they do. But like they're skirting this line with the Tolkien estate between what they can and cannot. So they're trying to throw these Easter eggs in for people like yourself that have been reading and loving this for 40 years. But they're also trying not to get their asses sued. What? This is how we create art in the 21st century.
Yeah, this is so weird. Why the divide here? Why is the Tolkien estate being so just hamstringing their own content here? I
think it's because Tolkien, the way they told it on the Lorehounds, is Tolkien didn't really want to sell the movie rights to his stuff, and he did because when he was in a pinch for money and he sold the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit. And
yeah, he also did it when technology wasn't available to even create one of these scenes, let alone every single one of them.
Yeah, I mean, they tried with the animation and the Ralph Bakshi stuff, and that stuff didn't really work. But I mean, I heard that like Christopher was kind of trying to uphold his dad's original wishes and not letting the Silmarillion and the Unfinished Tales and whatnot get, you know, like the not expand the license that his dad kind of always didn't like. And there's also hints that maybe the new estate holders, the grandchildren of Tolkien, are a little bit more like, hey, we want to get that money, and less like, you know, what would dad really care about, you know?
Is this some literature elitist kind of thing? I
think it's respect for your parents. Like, if your dad created a universe.
Well, from him, like, why was he so anti other forms of media?
Man, Tolkien's is an interesting guy, and I think that he like really saw a purity and a personal thing in his content, and his dealings with Hollywood were probably the opposite. I mean, think about dealing with the Hollywood of the 60s and 70s, you know, and how kind of exploitative they were with tales. And even today, it's not like you sell your story to Hollywood and you're guaranteed it's going to be treated with respect and dignity. So no, like
far from it.
And you know, he's like creating languages and high art. And I think he probably saw cinema as probably vulgar, to be honest. So
sure.
Yeah. So a little bit of a purist there. There's a lot more Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be back right after this short break. And now let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep. Got some speculation from J-Cubed. He says, I think I was hoping the Meteor Man might have been Tom Bombadil. I really didn't want it to be Gandalf, but now I'm almost positive it is, and we're seeing why Gandalf has such an affinity towards hobbits. That makes a lot of sense. I don't know about your Tom Bombadil, man, because the one thing that they established about Tom Bombadil is he is like this ancient eternal thing. I don't know why you'd take a joyride on a meteor to Earth and forget himself.
Was so upset wasn't in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and it's okay. One of those weird transition between the tone of The Hobbit and the early goings of The Lord of the Rings, where it's all about Bilbo and his magic ring and the birthday party and fun and adventure, and kind of then they go into the darker, like we're going to cut people's heads off and launch them over castle walls in the later goings of The Lord of the Rings. Tom Bombadil was kind of like that transition of where he was still telling a twee children's story. And there's this guy with the bright blue, yellow hat and the blue boots, and he's singing the trees, and, you know, he's immune to the ring's powers. And I don't think Tolkien to the day he died knew quite how to fit him into his legendarium. But him coming to Middle Earth on a comet would have probably created a lot of lore disputes. And he also says, I think Halbrand might end up becoming one of the Nine Kings of Men and become a Nazgul. He seems like the kind of dude that would take a ring from a sus stranger.
Nice.
Yeah. The kings of the Southlands don't have the best reputation, right? Like when Galadriel's like, yeah, unite them under banner, but this time do it for good. Boy, I could see that path. I could see that path paved with well intentions leading to hell. Dante backs up J-Cube's suspicions here. He says, I think Halbrand could be that kid's father. We talked about Bronwyn's child last episode. He also has the kind of low sense morality, is pretty self-involved, which means he's being set up to become a prime candidate for one of the nine to become the Nazgul.
Okay. I like the theory that he's the kid's father. Sure. Disappeared under mysterious circumstances. Kid doesn't know why. Halbrand's obviously running from something. He's from the area. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, and he's tied to that Morgul blade. That's the thing that really makes me real sus about him. Like, if that's... Totally. Yeah, where did he get that? Was that one of his dad's blade? Is that like the fucked up evil version of the sword that... the broken sword that Aragorn laid claim to? Niall O'Sidhai is how I want to take a stab at this. He signed this unpronounceable Irish name. So
okay.
I had a hard time with it. And he's got an interesting issue he wants to talk about. Longtime listener in Dublin here. There's been a lot of discourse about the actors of color and the Rings of Power, but I'm surprised to hear nothing about the questionable use of accents. The point has come up in British and Irish media so far, but I've heard nothing from American commentators. In case you don't get it, in T-Rop, there are beautiful, noble elves that all speak in Oxbridge English, and they're the dirty, smelly, if lovable, Harfoots who happen to speak in some type of stage Irish brogue. At best, this seems like an outdated and cutesy image of Irishness that's still sometimes found in movies, but at worst, it gets very close to the flat-out racist cartoons of Irish people and the likes of Punch magazine at the height of the British Empire, which we were routinely depicted as subhuman or, you guessed it, ape-like. This is interesting. I might talk about this here in a minute. It's not as if the Irish actors themselves are Irish. I'd love to know what the showrunners were thinking, unless we forget it's something they've actively decided to put in, as no one, it's not something we can pin on Tolkien. Plenty has been made of the accents of characters like Jar Jar Binks and Missaria and Hot D, so the Irish, are Irish people fair game, or do people just have a blind spot? As some people may have noticed on Twitter this week, Ireland is a country still deeply in recovering from colonialism, and this kind of representation does matter. Yeah, their reaction to the death of the Queen, a lot different than people in London, you would imagine. And he also said in a PS that he had heard this discussed on other American podcasts, and the hosts were kind of dismissive or weren't taking the issue seriously. What do you have any comments on this?
No, I think you're right. I think there's a blind spot for sure, because of skin pigmentation, honestly. It's like that's what it comes down to, right? Like the Irish are considered white, and so they're kind of fair game to be made fun of, to be lampooned, all sorts of things. Whereas if you try and do that with a black or Asian person, you're going to get just destroyed.
Yeah, like I find that all cultures have their kind of blind spots to the social faux pas and whatnot. In America, of course, we're centered on American history, and American history is defined more than almost anything over the issue of slavery.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like on the one perspective, the Irish people were brutally colonized by the English. I was watching an Irishman was interviewed by a black content creator because they're talking about this very thing about, you know, like colonialism is often seen as like a indigenous person of color type of thing. But some of those indigenous people were white, you know, and they were brutalized by other white people. Mm-hmm. And the Irish for centuries, millennia, had a dedicated state sponsored destruction of their religion, their culture, their language, even species of animal. Like there used to be a species of wolf that was very important spiritually, politically to the Irish, and they were hunted to extinction and eradicated. Jeez. as a deliberate, you know, act of cultural violence against them. And much the same way, it's like, you know, the queen is associated with her corgis. Like imagine if the Irish took over the England, they just extinguished all corgis from the land of Britain, right? It'd be seen as an affront, right?
Yeah.
The thing is, a lot of times when Irish issues are brought up in the context of America, it is whataboutism. It's very common for racist people to be like, we talk about the chattel slavery of black people in America, but did you know that the Irish were brought over as slaves and stuff? And like, while this is strictly true, the type of slavery that black people experienced was not the same as the type of indentured servitude / slavery that Irish people experienced, where that confinement was for a set period of time. Their children are not included in the deal. It's seen as kind of like a way to take away the legitimacy of the kind of unique stain on American everything that is slavery. So I think when you as an Irish person are bringing up this legitimate, probably dissonance that you're feeling, that like no one is taking this like, oh, they're speaking the Irish kind of stuff seriously, and associated that with less advanced, less educated people, you are feeling the friction across the sea of a lot of like Ku Klux Klan types that are using that as a way to dismiss criticism, the stuff that's going on our shores. And also, America's the melting pot. Like you mentioned that like ape imagery. I did a lot. So I did this political podcast a couple years ago called Three Right Turns. And one of the things that kind of helped me appreciate race in America was understanding my own people's history. Like I come from German peasants that immigrated to the country immediately after the Civil War, before World War One. And we were kind of like the shoeless, uneducated, illiterate, diseased, dirty immigrants of the day that were flooding the shores. And oh my God, what are we going to do with all these people? And we were, especially in World War One, depicted as like these dark skinned apes. Like you'd see like these gorillas with clubs, wearing the spiked helmet, Kaiser helmets, carrying off white blonde women. And like Jim's people, Irish Americans, Italian Americans, Irish Americans, we all took turns being that low person on the totem pole, being associated with the apes, being associated with this. But because we all share a certain pigment that the dominant culture in America shared, after a couple generations, you anglicize your name a little bit, you go to, you know, you lose your accent, and we just become white. You know, we get Cloroxed. So we don't. We can, you know, like we have a bunch of slurs, antiquated slurs that we could call each other and it wouldn't land because, like, you know, fuck, Irish people, German people, Italian people have been kind of embraced and treated as white among America in a way that hasn't happened for, you know, descendants of African slaves. So I think that is why in America we fuck this up. And I think it will probably be the job of the next 100 years for us all to kind of like figure out how we've hurt each other as we come together as a global species, God willing, and figure out all these places and have all these stories heard so that we can kind of all feel how things are differently and how things are the same. And we're just kind of in that period of all this coming together globally. And it sucks because, like I said, your valid issue is being used here in America as a way to be like, well, black people didn't really have it that bad and they should really get their shit together and get over their centuries of being treated as property.
Yeah. And then you have the other side of the argument here, which is like when people who were literally owned by others for generations encounter the argument from the Irish that also we were, you know, treated unfairly based on our race. Mm-hmm. Then they kind of laugh at that, right? Like, oh, well, that's the other side of the whataboutism. Well, what about like the worst experience that the black people had here in America? So
yeah,
you kind of get it from both sides when you bring those topics up.
Yeah.
And sucks. So you're right. It absolutely is a thing. And it's something that everyone needs to work on.
And it's deep, man. Like that's like that.
Yeah.
That, you know, you throw in a Scottish or an Irish brogue into like your rough and ready adventure character in a fantasy setting, like that's baked in really fucking deep in this culture. And it's a element of racism or culturism that we have just barely started peeling back. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. And I'm sorry, like I said, I'm sorry that you felt like this was dismissed in wider commentary. But like, I hope you understand maybe why progressive people in America would bristle when people start bringing up Irish stuff when we're talking about, you know, people of color's representation. Anyway, hopefully that helps everybody understand things a little bit better. If not, we're all stuck on this planet for hundreds and hundreds more years, probably thousands. We'll get there eventually. Or not. Or we'll all wipe each other out. Either way, it's fine with me. Chris B says, firstly, I totally agreed with your guys' assessment of this episode, and I've been a listener since the beginning of Bald Move. The writing and storytelling seems inconsistent. I can't help but wonder if we're seeing the results of different writing and directing teams running the different underconverged stories, such as the Harfeet, and the dwarfish stories are a delight, but have energy to their stories that some really clever writing. While some of the elvish stories, especially Galadriel, since she got on the boat, have weird pacing, odd, sometimes stilted dialogue, and dumb mysteries caused by people not asking obvious questions. We've seen this before, a series like the Game of Thrones or Stranger Things, when they're dealing with multiple threads. Usually, though, in those cases, it's the side stories that suffer. In this case, the side stories are the ones shining. I hope they start to recenter the elvish stories rather than the wobble getting worse and worse until it runs off the road. I think this is an underappreciated facet of television creating, as you're probably right. Like, a lot of writers get credit for the entire episode that gets broken down by the writing room, and you'll probably have people assigned to like plots and threads. So like, it gives the appearance of like this person did this one episode. When reality, you had a whole bunch of people, probably second unit directors and all stuff contributing to this. Do you think that this kind of piecemeal makes some of this stuff feel a little bit more uneven, or?
It might. I'm not familiar with the structure of the writer's room here. Because it varies. Like, that's the thing about writer's rooms. No two rooms are the same.
Yes.
I think there's like sometimes a general pattern that people fall into when making television. Like,
yes.
Okay, you break the story and then you divide that into episodes and you assign certain people a certain episode to write. I think that's generally how it goes. And then, you know, you come together with your whole writer's room. You review the script as the writer wrote it. People contribute ideas and then you go back for another draft. Generally, that's true, but that's not always true. That's not even close to always true. So I don't know what the writer's room looks like here, but it's certainly possible that that's what's happening, that you have certain writers sort of assigned, hey, you are, you know, the Galadriel team, right? Or you are the Numenor team or whatever. And they come back with stories that no one's really going to question too much, maybe, because they're assigned to do them. I don't know. Hello,
yeah, and one of the flashing red lights I had about this is the showrunners, who look like very young elf lords themselves, don't have a lot of experience They've worked on pretty small projects leading up to this, and they were kind of a blank slate as far as, you know, their creative talent. I think, like, they don't even have articles on Wikipedia. And you look them up on IMDb, and if they've done stuff like, you know, they both worked in this show called Escape and Uprising, which I've never heard of. Apparently, they were involved in a Flash Gordon adaptation, which I wasn't familiar with. And then they've got a $500 million enterprise that they've been put in charge of. So
that seems insane to me. Absolutely,
it does
insane
seem
from
insane
Amazon's
to me.
Perspective. Why
it does
would
seem insane.
You hire someone without extensive experience making one of the most complicated and expensive productions ever made on
television? Well, I wish I saw these guys' Wikipedia articles, but because I bet their parents would have blue links too. I mean, you'll recall that, like, the Double D's, sure. Dan and David over on Game of Thrones, that was their first kind of thing. They had written some stuff, and they were these young kids that studied abroad.
Anybody expected Game of Thrones to turn into what Game of Thrones turned into?
But Game of Thrones, HBO did spend a lot of money, even like reshot the pilot twice. They spent a lot of money getting that off the ground. Yeah. Ryan Condal doesn't have the kind of, you know, because like if I was HBO or Amazon, I'd be looking for the Vince Gilligans. I'd be looking for the Terrence Winters. I'd be looking for people that have told big fucking, it doesn't even have to be sword and sandal shit. Just like, could you tell a big compelling story and bring it to a satisfying emotional arc? Do you understand how to tell stories, how to do cinematography? Do you know how to run an effect? But it seems like, I don't know, like I honestly don't know anything about the showrunners. So this could be concerns. I don't know. Secondly, I think the move to New Zealand is really going to hit the visual beauty in season two. I grew up in New Zealand, spent my young years in the rural North Island, and went to university on the South Island, where I studied ecology and earth science and explored damn near the whole country. As a traveled Kiwi, I can recognize all the landscapes and the shots, and I can see that hardly anything other than built elements is being composited in. This in turn ties the series into the Peter Jackson movies. I've also traveled around the UK and Europe, and while there are many beautiful places, it won't look and feel the same at all. I guess we'll feel like Game of Thrones, which of course shot all over Europe. I know there's all kinds of reasons the studio has given for this change, but it all boils down to money in Jeff's pocket. I think no matter how great or mediocre season one ends up being, season two is going to lack a lot of the magic because of the lack of setting.
Super interesting, because I was watching House of the Dragon last night and this idea came through my head. I'm watching House of the Dragon. I'm going, this doesn't feel anything like the Rings of Power.
Yeah.
Because everything I'm seeing is just, like I said about the, you know, documentary shows and sports shows, sports games on film, it's just pointing a camera at a thing that already exists. And I know that's not true of everything in Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon, but you get a lot of stuff for free. And
yeah,
getting the lighting right is like a huge part of what makes a visual effects shot work. And it's a lot harder to do that when you have to create all the lighting and you're standing in, you know, something like the volume or whatever, trying to match lighting to a composite shot that you're going to do that hasn't been done yet by a visual effects artist down the road. Yeah. I think taking it out of the natural beauty of New Zealand is going to definitely have an effect on how it looks, because those European shots don't look anything like what I'm seeing on Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I'm sure they can do a pretty good job, and I'm sure they shot a lot of like establishing shots so they can then layer those composites in later. But I agree, like, New Zealand is Middle Earth, and I just thought it was persuasive that essentially James Cameron rented out all of New Zealand for the next 3 years and just closed the filmmaking. Like, that's clearly bullshit. It's clearly a cost saving measure. But whether it bites them in the ass, I don't know, because if they're smart, they thought a couple seasons ahead and got all the establishing shots and film it all in like 8K, 16K, whatever resolution. So they've got this stuff in mind, like, hey, we're going to need a shot for this. We're going to need a shot for this. But if they didn't, and they're still going to have to composite, like Jim says, you can't just take them and drop them off in a field in front of Miris Tirith and everything looks good. They're going to have to composite that. I don't know. It's something I am worried about for sure.
The lighting alone, like, are they going to be able to shoot outside at all? Because the light in Europe looks a lot different than it does in New Zealand.
Is this true?
I mean, look at every shot you've ever seen.
The sun looks different reflected through. But they do so much color correction on, especially House of Dragons and Lord of the Rings.
Four clear days a year in England?
Like, you do. Okay. You're fair. Fair. Yeah. The sun is not the same in England when it only shines 4 days a year. Yeah, I get you there.
Right? Like, how are you going to film?
Seems like New Zealand's blessed
there
with just incredibly seasonable weather all year long. But yeah. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Chris has the following to contribute. I'm wondering how you're feeling about how the show has mixed stand-ins or similar references to the main Lord of the Rings character and story. For example, we've got a king who hasn't taken up his mantle. Harfoot's disparaging about a troublemaker in the Shire. Numenor leaders similar to when we got the Gondor, some obvious, some less so. Is this too direct and obvious an execution to make the viewer feel familiar? While I'm enjoying the show, I did want to see how things were different. I think the opening gave me this new elements, but the further we go, it seems to be reverting more to these safety points. What do you think? Because like when he lays it out like this, you're right. The Numenoreans seem very much like the people of Gondor, like these bitter minor bureaucrats who are mad that the real big pants people are in town, you know? And the Harfoots are, we got this wizard guy. Oh, what are we going to do? He's causing adventure and calls to journeying. A king who's got a broken blade who might be able to unite the people.
A lot of this is just cyclical, right? In the storytelling. Yeah.
It rhymes, yeah.
So it just kind of follows that it would be similar.
And I don't know, because like, know. You know, that's a common complaint leveled at Star Wars, that like Return of the Jedi, sure, and the Force Awakens are all essentially just remakes of the same fucking movie. But I thought Return of the Jedi is pretty damn cool. I thought The Force Awakens was a fine start to a new trilogy that largely, in my mind, ended in tears. But I just don't know, because like I said, it's you know, my mom taught English, and one of the things I quickly appreciated is there are not that many novel stories. There's only so many things that can happen to a human on this earth, and you put in magic and folklore, like, you know, you can give different reskins of the same content, but it's always man versus man, man versus nature, boy meets girl. Like, there's only so many twists you can do on that, the monomyth, you know? So, like, that doesn't mean that every time a movie comes out, it's going to be a trash rehash of something that was done back in Gilgamesh's day, right?
I mean,
it's all about the execution.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And to drive that point home, I read an article a long time ago about story arcs. I just looked it up, and if you really want me to just ruin your enjoyment of all media, here we go. There are 6 actual story arcs that any story can take. 1, rags to riches. 2, riches to rags. 3, man in a hole, which is fall and then rise. Double man in a hole, which is fall, rise, fall, rise. Icarus story arc, which is rise and then fall. Cinderella, rise, fall, rise. And Oedipus, which is fall, rise, fall. And that's it. That's it. Like, generally speaking, those are the only 6 stories you can tell in their structure. And every piece of media you've ever seen will fall into one of those patterns. So, yes, I get why a lot of this would feel similar, because all stories are basically the same thing.
And the thing is, we're not going to know. Like, we will know a little bit at the end of this season. I think we'll know if things could still be good. Like, I think we might see enough in the first season if this show is just going to be bad, which I've almost eliminated that possibility. But we won't know if this show is truly good for another 2 seasons, probably. Because it's easy to begin things that are interesting. It's a lot harder to end them, and especially at this kind of epic scale. So we'll just have to see.
And we know generally where this thing is going. Like, that's the thing I'm trying to avoid, you know, specific spoilers and stuff that's going to tell me where these characters end up, other than the ones I already know from Lord of the Rings. But yeah, generally we know where this story leads.
Double T says, hey guys, I have a different take on Galadriel's surprise at Numenor closing itself off from the elves. It came down to a theme that's already been well established, that is the different perspective for time the elves have compared to other races. I said we'd return to this, and here we are. The episode tells us that the Numenorians withdrew the welcome mat to elves quite recently. We know it's because the Queen Regent's predecessors had different ideas. Even if that occurred many years early, we know that decades can pass and seem like barely any time for an elf. It's implied that Galadriel's expedition to find Sauron following the end of the First Age had been a long one. Yeah, like hundreds of years, centuries. Even from the perspective of the elves in her party who were complaining about how long and fruitless it had been. So I found it realistic to Galadriel to return from that long period away and not be aware of the latest in Numenorean foreign policy. This is a really good point and something that we're like, I forgot the show I was watching. They just showed that Galadriel had been off to the far flung regions of the elves or of the world in her desperate search for what had become of Sauron and Morgoth. So she probably did miss a lot of this frosting of the relationship here. So, yeah, no, that's an on point criticism. And I'm going to try to take that going forward. David, our buddies from the Lorehound, said, had to write in on the regular feedback section because I had to marvel at the fact that Numenorean sailors were all wearing breastplate armor. It seems a little crazy to me. I'm a big Aubrey Matron fan myself. This is the Master and Commander series. And enjoy the idea of seafaring life a bit, so I was surprised to see them dressed this way. This goes back, so like I searched, it's so funny because I searched, can a person in full plate armor swim? And do you know what the first result was?
Take the armor off, you dummy? I don't know.
No, it's a pointing to the Bald Moose forum where I asked this very question when Jamie got thrown into the river wearing full plate armor. And there's this guy who wears like 50 pounds of custom fit armor and he tries to swim in Olympic size swimming pool and the guy can barely make it 10 feet. And I do not think if he was in the deep end that he would be able to rise above again. It seems.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was wild. But on the other hand, I remember from reading the Aubrey Matron books that a lot of those sailors were very superstitious about learning how to swim, because in their idea, if you were in a place that you needed to swim, you were probably going to prolong your agonies of drowning because your ship is sunk. You know, or you fell overboard in the middle of a battle, or at the you do not want to get off the ship. And if you do, you're a dead man. So why learn how to swim? You might as well just fill your. Maybe there's a little bit of that the Numenoreans, like the Iron Islanders in Game of Thrones, would wear full plate armor. And that was seen as a sign of faith in the sea that, like, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. These people trying to put an axe through me on the deck, I can't trust. The sea, I can trust. Maybe they're trying to put that same kind of thing behind the Numenoreans.
Sure.
Regardless, the ship design and sail riggings is off the charts. I even love the detail of what might be a studding sail or maybe a skysail up in between the two main sails. So studding sails or stunsails are sails they attach to the sides of the main rigging to get extra oomph in calm winds. And skysails are the extra sails they put above the main masts during periods of calm seas to get all the air that they've got. You would put these down immediately if the wind picked up because it just tear your masts off. Mm-hmm. But now I was because like this side by side, this side by side mast system would be just the devil itself for going what they call running before the wind when the wind's right to your back and you want to catch all that stuff. But I wonder how they would function if the wind's coming from a side, because most ships can sail somewhat into the wind. They can't sail right into it, but, you know, like 45 degrees in either direction, you can kind of sail and zigzag up. I have no fucking clue how these things would work trying to beat up into the wind. Maybe we'll see. But he says, fingers crossed, we'll get some more Numenorean sailing action. I would love that because I'm a big fan of the sails myself. There's a lot more Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be back right after this short break. And now let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep. So we have a last kind of a deep dive into the lore that's going to kick off our lore segment. And I want to choose to read this because it's a pretty, like, there's nothing for Lorehounds to comment on. This is just pretty factual information. It's background information for Elros and Elrond, the half-elven. So you have Arendil, their father. Their father is Arendil the Mariner, who is a half-elven. He was the one who went and spoke to the Valar, the gods, to persuade them to forgive elves and men and come to their aid in the Battle of Morgoth. Arendil was allowed to do this when others had failed exactly because he was half-elf. He was the one who could speak on behalf of both of the kindreds, and he was still considered mortal man by the gods at the time. He'd made this journey after all the elven strongholds had been destroyed and all hope was lost. Presumably, when you saw the elves swimming in the fire seas with a spear stuck through their chest, that's when Arendil, the beloved, took pity or went to speak to them. Anyway, the gods listened, took pity. He then accompanied the mighty host that returned to Middle Earth to defeat Morgoth in the last battle. It was Arendil in a ship that can now magically fly, along with the eagles who defeated the flying dragons and were unleashed in the tempest of lightning and flame in the last stand of Morgoth. Elwing was their mother, who was also half-elven, and the granddaughter of Beren, a man, and Luthien, an elf. You might recognize those names as being pretty big famous names in the Tolkien canon. Elwing was the keeper of a Simaril that Beren had cut from the crown of Morgoth as his bride price for marrying Luthien. Luthien had even more magical blood because her mother was the Maia, a lesser god called Melian. So the Maiar were a step below the Valar in terms of demigoggery. They're,
oh my god, you're killing me. Oh my semi-gods? God, I feel the elf juice leaking out.
Look, guys, there's only so much elf juice that Jim's got. And every time I hit him with a Fëanor, that the elf juice drains. It's just like a pool of sweat appears on his head, trickles down. That's elf juice we're never going to get back. Okay,
I'm never getting it back.
So you have Elendil, who is the guy, that guy's light was in the file of Elendil, I think, that Galadriel gave Frodo in the Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
You got Elwing, their demigod mother. They met and lived in the last refuge of the elves where Elrond and Elros were born. So you know Elrond. We heard Elros found in Numenor here.
Where does their refuge fit into this all?
He's the king who still lives.
Okay.
Their refuge was attacked by the last sons of Fëanor when Arendil was out marinering. Elrond and Elros were captured, and Elwing escaped to the sea with the Simaril. She is magically saved and delivered to Arendil's ship by one of the gods. It was then by the light of the Simaril that they were able to find the passage into the Undying Lands and plead on behalf of both elves and men. Because of these great deeds, the half-elven family were all allowed to choose their fates. This is the defining feature of the half-elves. Elwing, Arendil, and Elrond chose to be counted with the elves and Elros with men. This is also why Arwen gets to make this choice in Lord of the Rings. Do you remember her saying to her father that she chooses a mortal life? As she is part of this family, it's also why Elros is given the island of Numenor with the faithful. In summary, Arendil and Elwing are super important and special to both elves and men. Together, they are allowed to reach the Undying Lands. He convinced the gods to save the elves and men when no one else could. Elrond and Elros, as his sons, are unique among the peoples of Middle-earth because they also share high lineage with the Maia. So there you go. He says he wanted to continue this or include his backstory because it's all first-age stuff. And it's amongst the stuff that the Tolkien family is most jealously protecting and their estate. So we probably won't get this information directly told to us. So if you want to know the backstory that we won't hear otherwise, there it is. And this also kicks off the Lorehound segment, the lore part of the cast. Now for the lore cast, I've got John from the Lorehounds. We're going just you and me. The fellowship has shrunk to two. Your buddy David is heading for the Easterlands?
Yeah, he's going all the way to hang out with elephants and whatever else you can find from the east.
Olyphants, Mr. John, he's going to see. He's heading over to Europe, so he'll be gone for a couple weeks. Me and Jim are going to be helping John out on the Lore podcast, and he's here helping us out. And Jim said, you know, that last email or two with the names and everything just broke me. I'm tapping out. It's just John and I tonight for the lore heavy lifting. So let's get right to it. Lauren has a question about Dwarven secret theory. You know, I talked about that second episode that they had the mystery MacGuffin box, and I thought it was Mithril. I think some people were guessing it might be the Arkenstone, which I didn't think it was right chronologically for that or even spatially. Yeah. But we got a third theory. My first thought was also Mithril, but I was struck by the glow that a pure, clear, silvery light it emanated, or emitted rather. It reminded me of the light of Elendil that Galadriel gives Frodo in a bottle. We talked about Elendil. Or not Arendelle, as I think she's saying Elendil, but she means Arendelle because it's really easy to get that confused. I also recall the second tree in Valinor being a silvery white. I think the Durins have at least one Simmeril. Didn't the king mention, does he know, or something like that to Durin? We know Elrond highly respects elven smithing, and he relayed the story of the Simmerils when he was with Celebrimbor. John, what's your read on the likelihood of the mystery MacGuffin box containing a Simmeril?
All right. If we're going accurate to the lore, there is zero chance here, because the Silmarillion portion, the Quenta Silmarillion portion of the Silmarillion, that's the story of what happened to the Silmarils, how the Noldor created them and lost them and went to war for them. That ends with the Silmarils fulfilling this prophecy from Mandos, the Doomvella. Doom is in fate. That means that the Silmarils will end up one in the sky, one in the earth, and one in the sea. And at this point, they're there. Now, Tolkien did have the opportunity to bring back in a Silmaril with the Arkenstone, as you mentioned before. Could have done that with the dwarves there, but one that was in Erebor, that was in the Lonely Mountain, that we saw in the Hobbit movies, the Hobbit books. And two, it was not a Silmaril. He explicitly said this is not a Silmaril.
Okay. So it'd be not that this show seems like it's going to be shy from deviating to the canon where it needs to, wants to fill in holes. But that would be pretty big, reach.
Yeah, because that's supposed to be pretty final. And I'll say this. I think that the reason that they're going so hard on the Silmaril stuff is because they want you to understand Elvish politics. And they all go back to what happened with those jewels in the First Age.
Right. Okay, Henry says, in canon, isn't Galadriel like 6'4"? Can she not grow until she defeats Sauron? She seems very tiny in the show.
She does seem pretty tiny in the show.
Can I also say that I was just reading a random lore article about Elendil the Tall? Yeah. And I guess canonically, he's 7'11" tall.
Yeah, that was actually the thing I was going to bring in. I dug into Unfinished Tales. And I look, they have these random Numenorean measurements that I will not bore you with, but essentially he's like half a yard taller than Galadriel. And so even if she is very tall, it is not unreasonable that he is towering over her.
Yeah.
And then again.
Yeah. I also say that I don't see any of that in the show. Like it wasn't like Elendil was. Yeah, like Yao Ming plus Yao Ming standing on a milk crate tall. Is that because, like, to me, this is reflections of Tolkien kind of like refactoring his biblical stuff, because in the really old parts of the Bible, in the Genesis, there were these men of fame that were kind of like half angel, half men that grew to like preposterous proportions, and they lived extremely long lives. I think there's some of this kind of like half remembered mythology that Tolkien was incorporating to kind of sprinkle in, like, oh, these are literally supermen.
Yeah. I mean,
Ubermensch.
Yeah, there's a ton of that. I mean, I think I sent you and Jim a message how, like, the story of the end of Numenor is really the same story as the end of Judah. Like, he just copy pasted that. But as far as the height thing, all Numenoreans are essentially the Galadriel height. So she should be about eye level with the average Numenorean.
Oh
yeah, they're all about 6'4".
I forgot this is a show that does adjust. So they could. It could be that we see when. Well, but so are we supposed to understand that what is his name? Halbrand is
That's
he super tall
point.
Too? Because he's got the blood of the First Men coursing through his veins or some shit too.
I mean, if what he has said is true and he is from the Southlands, he should not be related to the Edain. The Edain, which are the people who become the Numenoreans. He should be regular man height. I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. I would rather them have actors that encompass the character more than I would rather them have Galadriel be an accurate Amazon.
Yeah, right. Yeah, 6'4" women and 7'11" men just are not to be found in Hollywood. You can't just pick up a phone book and,
it's
you
true.
Know. Henry also says, lastly, why do some orcs talk and others don't? The orc that was in Bronwyn's house, was that a feral orc? has he not been domesticated yet? I'm not sure if there's an explanation for this. Can I take a crack at it and see what the lore master says? So canonically, the orcs speak the black speech, right? But they can speak the common tongue of man. It's my guess that the orc in the house just didn't bother. He was there. He was just going to kill these people. He didn't give a shit about being communicated or understanding being communicated. Whereas the guys running the slave pits are trying to communicate with their slaves. And so they're using, you know, they're wanting to be understood. Is that about right?
I think that's a perfect explanation.
What did I get wrong there?
Yep. I think that they only learned Western. They only learned the common speech because they needed it for their slaves, and they needed it to work with like the men who had turned toward Morgoth.
Can I ask you this? And if I'm putting you on the spot, you know, because like I said, the Tolkien lore is limitless. Is the black speech is the black speech a corrupted form of Quenya?
Don't know. But I can dig into that for you. I believe it is a corrupted form of Elvish, yeah.
Okay, because that's interesting because just as Morgoth has said of twisted creation into his various forms, it's kind of interesting that like the gift of the elves, the language was also twisted.
Well,
you know,
the technically canon version of the orc origin is in the Silmarillion, and that is that Morgoth created orcs based on corrupted elves. However,
right.
Tolkien was really bothered by that in the end because he thought it messed with like free will, and he thought it messed with like elves being this perfect man before the fall character. So that's it's problematic. I think Christopher made a little bit of a weird call with including that in the Silmarillion. But yeah, that would make sense as why you had a corrupted form of Quenya become the black speech, if that is what it is. I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Matt from Quebec says, in the first feedback on T-Rop, you guys talked about the fact that Arendir would have watched Bronwyn grow up from infancy and how weird that might have been. For sure, that'd be true for human-elf relationships, but I think it would be true for a lot of elf-elf relationships as well. If Elrond got sweet on a lady or man-elf 1,500 years from the time of the show, for sure, you would have seen that elf grow up. While an age gap of 20, 30, or 40 years would raise progressively more eyebrows in the human world, would a 100-year gap be that big a deal between a 2,700-year-old elf and a 2,600-year-old elf? 200 years? 500 years? All I'm saying is it seems like elven society would almost have to have been pretty accepting of relationships between folks with age gaps that would be impossibly long for humans, including the fact that they might have known each other when one was an elf grown and the other still crapping in their little elven britches. and then we'll have a side note that I want to talk to. Do you have any idea? Because like to me, I guess in my head that like once an elf reaches full grown maturity, which I can't remember if that's like 100 or however many years it takes for them to develop that like they'd essentially be fair game. I don't know if like a 9,000-year-old first elf Noldor would stoop so low to cradle rob a 100-year-old, but like I don't think a 1,500-year-old elf getting with a 300-year-old elf would raise too many elf brows.
All right, so this opens up a whole can of worms that I would direct you to the elf episode of the Second Age that we did, chapter 3. On our Lorehounds feed, because that I go deep into that, and it is debatable within Tolkien. If you want a direct source, the nature of Middle Earth goes into this, but the aging of elves is both debatable and really complicated. The long short of it is that depending on where they live, they age at about 1 human year to 100 human years to 1 elf year. I keep saying ears because I'm so focused on their pointy ears. No,
sure. It's because you're racist.
It's
towards
true.
Elves, you
it's
know?
True.
You want to say
not as much as Galadriel,
but
yeah. I mean, not as much as Galadriel is racist towards the men in Numenor. Oh my god.
True.
But yeah. So basically, like 100 to 1 is their aging ratio in some writings of Tolkien, but they do age sort of normally. Like they can have kids in their like mid 20s, so around like 2,500 years old. And they have like a window where they can have kids. They have a window where they start to get old. And as they fade, they become like invisible to the human eye. And they just sort right. of start to fade. But their essence basically survives until the end of all creation.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's how they age. That's kind of complicated. As far as like age differences in a relationship, yeah, that's definitely like acceptable more in Elvish culture. I mean, you can, this is a spoiler for the Lord of the Rings, but I feel like most people watching the show are already there for Elrond does marry an elf, his junior, and a Celebrian, and they have a daughter together, and it's fine, and nobody cares about it. So yes, they are much more used to that. However, I do think that it is a little bit different in the culture, whereas like a human growing up a lot faster will have less time to like attune themselves to the world around them and to like, you know, you want to bring in grooming, like things like that. Right. So I do think that it's a little grosser for an elf, an elf who knows a human as a baby rather than an elf who knows an elf as a baby.
Well, and you think of the great love, human elf love affairs, I'm thinking like Beren and Luthien. Uh-huh. They came across like Beren was a man full grown, Luthien was an elf, you know, ready for marrying age, and they come across each other in like a forest clearing, and it's kind of love at first sight. That's a lot different than the Borwin or Bronwyn and Arendir, where he is assigned not to her village because she's from a different village, but I thought that this Osterith fortification probably served the entire region. Yeah. So I feel like Arendir has probably seen her grow up. Maybe he wasn't aware of her at first. But I feel like it's, and again, I'm not going to say it's creepy because I don't know like what, you know, I didn't see how he interacted with her when she was a little girl and whatnot. But I feel like it's a different when someone is watching someone grow up and like, oh, wait until the fruit ripens and I'll pluck it, versus you come, you know, full grown for your species, your race, and you meet on equal footing, and that's a completely, you know, because it's all about the power imbalances. When we're talking about creepy, other than the, you know, the incest type biological bugaboo taboo, it's power imbalance. Does someone have an imbalance in power, knowledge, wisdom, money, whatever, that they are leveraging to get into someone's pants? Mm-hmm. And that's where it makes it real creepy. The follow-on question from Matt was, it seems like monogamy for eternity would require elves to have willpower beyond the grasp of mortals, but maybe that was part of the gift or curse Uru Iluvatar bestowed upon them from the beginning. What say you about elvish libido and passion?
Yeah, I mean, elves to Tolkien are man before the fall. They are perfect humans, basically, so... Yep, they're not cheating on their spouses. They are just doing the right thing all the time, even if they're assholes a little bit sometimes. They are always on the side of good. They're always doing, at least trying to do the right thing. So, yep, you're right. That's basically how Eru Iluvatar made them.
I read because when you guys got into this chapter 3, the elves, I went and did like a deep dive of myself because I find this stuff fascinating. And especially since I didn't have to remember it, I've got you guys there for that. I just started reading. And one thing that stuck in my mind is, you know, and the idea of Tolkien being the quintessential Catholic and that the elves being kind of like perfect Catholic people, is that the way they described it is like elves, when they get into their equivalent 20s, kind of become quickly inflamed with passion, where it's like, oh my God, this is the most beautiful, sexiest, handsomest elf. And they write poetry and they court each other and they kiss and they neck and they get together and they get married and then they pump out a few kids, however much their elf vitality. And then in middle age, that passion, not into like an act of dislike, like they're an old married couple and they hate each other, but like they start painting more and doing more quilting. Yep. And their love affair is like into kind of the history. So it's like they do what they do. They have sex to procreate, and then they don't do that filthy stuff no more. They turn their thoughts to higher things. And I thought that was interesting because that's essentially how a good Christian should do. You know, you stop all this unseemly sex when you get too old and you've had enough kids and you just pursue higher pursuits.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, there's even more if you want to dig into that. Like when elves first awoke. Tolkien once wrote that they awoke in Quivienen in the waters next to their soulmate. And they would just and that the the male elves just couldn't wait to see their female spouses, so they woke them up a little too early, which is why female elves age more quickly, and because they were built to wake up later. It's a whole thing, like, you know, soulmates and all that. And
any truth that Aragorn gave up his life and relinquished his strength when Arwen went into elven menopause? It's like, no reason for me to be around anymore.
Oh my gosh.
There's no more elf nookie, so I'm just going to pass on the throne to my son and check and punch
out. It's all over.
It's all dead bedroom. that's what brought Aragorn down. All right, that's the lore questions we got. Actually, there's a little bit of a deep lore, maybe a little bit too spoilery. I'm going to bump like a volleyball over to you, set up for a set and spike that you'll be talking about perhaps on next week's lore podcast, whatever. Yeah. So, Doug, if you didn't hear our responses because I'm kicking at the lore hounds, we'll see what they do with it. John, would you like to tell people where they can find and follow along with the Lorehounds throughout the remainder of the season?
Yeah, so we are every Monday putting out a Lorecast where we dig into a couple deep lore topics that we see during the episode. We talk about anything that we're getting in feedback at secondage@baldmove.com. And we're actually having a couple guests over the next few weeks because my Lorehound pal David is out of the country, so we have Marilyn Pukila coming on this week to talk to me about magic in Tolkien and his conception of it, because you know, it's a soft magic system. It's interesting, but it's not that well defined. But how did he look at that? I think that's super fascinating. And then maybe another guest that I am not ready to announce yet, but we got a lot of great content coming on. We have you and Jim coming on, and we're really excited about that. So you can find us at the Lorehounds feed. You can follow us on Twitter at the Lorehounds or talk to us on the Bald Move Discord.
Sounds good. Looking forward to talking to you again next week. Jim will be guesting on the show to help you out on the lore side. And of course, you'll be back for the lore corner. Mm-hmm. Thanks again, John. And that will do it for our show. Jim, like I said, already tapped out. If you want to send us feedback for this show, it's Doug2Deep@baldmove.com. Of course, you can follow everything that Bald Move does on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove. Join us at that Discord John was talking about, discord.baldmove.com. And if you want to get access to ad-free feeds and special features like our Instant Take and Instant Talk podcast for House of the Dragon, as well as Lunch with Jim and Aaron, our first run movies, quips, all of our bonus content, it's really easy to do. So support.baldmove.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week with another episode of Doug Too Deep and the Lorehounds Lorecast. Until then, I'm Aaron and this is John. See you, John, next week.
See ya.